You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 27th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
What say you?
Hello, all.
So, guys, we have a lot of conferences coming up. We're getting into our conference season, as it were. Next up is Nexus. July 12th to 15th, New York City.
Oh, my gosh. So
we
soon.
We have an update.
We do?
Yes, we do.
It's a big one.
Boy.
Bill Nye will be joining us.
Whoa.
Yay,
William
Bill.
Nye.
Yep.
He
Bill
must
Nye
like us.
Science guy.
Yeah, I mean, he basically has an open invitation to come to Nexus, and he has informed us that he's coming. So he's going to, at the very least, be a guest on the SGU live show, which is always fun. And we'll work him in elsewhere. This is just happening today, so we haven't finalized everything yet, but he's definitely going to be there. We'll definitely be on the SGU show and more to be determined, to be announced.
I think we should just give him an hour time slot and play some really cool music, and he can just dance.
Yeah.
You know? Good call.
I think half of New York City would show up for that, personally.
Yeah, think so?
I would, yeah.
That's right. And then after Nexus, we have Dragon Con, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, DragonCon is a blast.
Oh, so much fun. Can't wait.
Yeah, so that's August 30th to September 3rd in Atlanta. It's a fun convention. It's like you totally nerd out for a few days. But, you know, we always do a live show there. We'll be, you know, on panels and other stuff. Again, all still in the works at the moment.
Yeah, and we usually schedule a private show there as well. And that's usually our Dragon Con private show is usually one of the best shows of the year that we have. I mean, usually it's with a very intimate crowd.
Yeah, and it's also usually really late at night. So, like, we're talking out of all of our orifices.
That's right. Yeah, and Kara, I was saying I want you at Dragon Con this year. I want you to really get into the costuming.
Yeah, say that.
Yep.
I love how you want to convert me. You deeply want to convert me.
We love you that much, okay?
You want to share the joy.
We don't convert many people, but we want you.
Kara, resistance is futile.
Uh-oh. Oh,
no. And it hurts sometimes.
Oh.
And then when we hit October, that's our book tour extravaganza is happening. So we're trying to get a panel for Comic-Con. Actually, what I should say is that our publisher is trying to get us a panel at Comic-Con New York. So that may happen, but there's nothing official there yet. But what is official is that we are going to QED in Manchester.
Aha.
That is October 12th through 14th. But on the Thursday before QED, Thursday, October 11th, we are doing an extravaganza. We haven't done one of those in a couple of years. George Robb will be joining us. It is going to be a lot of fun. An updated extravaganza in Manchester.
Yay! That's awesome.
And this is also going to be part of our book tour, because our book comes out on October 2nd. And we also have a UK publisher, so the book will be coming out in the UK. And so we're going to be promoting the book as much as we can. So this is our tentative schedule. We wanted to get this out there so people know. So we'll be obviously doing the extravaganza on Thursday the 11th. We'll be at QED the 12th to the 14th. Then we are going up to Edinburgh, Scotland. Richard Wiseman will be up there. We are going to be hooking up with the Edinburgh Skeptics. We haven't worked anything out yet. I just got their contact information. But we'll be talking. Hopefully, we'll be able to make something happen when we're in Edinburgh. We'll be there Monday and Tuesday. And then we're going down to London on October 17th, staying through Sunday the 21st. So we're starting to plan some fun stuff in London, but we'd also like to hook up with any skeptics there. The publishers may be scheduling stuff for us to do in terms of promoting the book. So that should be a lot of fun as well. So we want to put this out there now in case there's any listeners out there in any of these cities who want to help us schedule events to do or stuff to do. Also, we may need some help moving around the UK. So specifically, I think we're going to be flying into London on that Wednesday the 10th. So if there's anybody in London who's driving to Manchester for QED, let us know. Mm-hmm. If you'd want to hang out with us while you drive us to Manchester.
throw us in the boot of the lorry.
Whatever.
We'll head up to Manchester.
Well, what happened was we were going to take the train, but then we found out that it's not all like a murder mystery thing happening on the train, that it's actually just a regular train ride? Because I thought every train ride in London in England was like, you know, there had to be a murder mystery.
Right, Agatha Christie.
I thought they were still using those. They were still using steam engines, right?
Everything's
coal-fired steam engines.
Yeah, like the Hogwarts Express, right?
Yeah.
That's what they use there. Jay, we got this. We're LARPers here, and we'll teach Kara. We'll turn that train ride into a LARP, and we'll make our own.
We'll just do it.
We should do our own mystery. It won't necessarily have to be a murder mystery, but we will do an impromptu LARP event on the train.
That's right.
As we're training around the UK.
And do you know what the most muttered statement on that train is going to be?
Cor blimey.
Fucking Americans is going to be the most muttered statement.
Bloody Yanks.
Oh, God. No, it's going to be, is that Bob?
Have any of you ever been to England?
Yes, nope. I've been there twice.
Okay,
I flew over it once.
You kind of seem to have a misunderstanding of what the country is like.
No.
Everyone was wearing bowlers and top hats. And
yeah. That's right.
They were constantly drinking tea and eating crumpets.
That's right.
That's exactly what it was like.
Awakening.
Bobby's on every corner with their sticks.
And, you know, Scotland's yard is not in Scotland, nor is it a yard. So
yeah.
There you go. That
always confused me when I was younger, that Scotland Yard was actually like the English. I said, why
UK?
Scotland? I know, but whatever. Just, I didn't have it all sorted out in my head when I was a little kid. You know, just it was confusing. Yeah, we are really looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun. And we want to just get as much out of it as we can while we're there. So let's move on. Kara.
Yes.
What's the word?
Ooh, so the word this week, oftentimes I pull a word from amazing email recommendations from you guys who listen to the show. But the word this week actually came from, I was interviewing somebody for my other podcast for Talk Nerdy. It hasn't aired yet. And she was dropping all these great vocab words left and right. And I was like, you know, feverishly writing them down in my SGU Google Doc. And I loved the sound of the word endophyte. And I thought that this would be a great addition to some other fight. Remember our fight club that we started?
That's right.
Maybe we can fill up the t-shirt.
Bob's right.
Crap. With all the different fights that we've come up with. So we talked a little bit about epiphytes previously. This week I wanted to talk about endophytes. And of course, what do you think that prefix leads to? Inside. Mm-hmm. So remember, endophyte, the phyte suffix here refers to the plant that the things live in. It doesn't refer to the things living in it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So oftentimes endophytes are actually like fungal. Sometimes they're bacterial. Usually it's a different kind of species that lives within a plant, and that is called an endophyte species. They are symbionts. It's parasitic if it's in there and it's actually destroying the host plant. But because this is an endosymbiont, it is living functionally. It's not always the whole life cycle. Oftentimes it's just part of the life cycle that occurs within the plant and, you know, again, doesn't cause disease. It seems like from the different sources that I've seen, but some of them don't list an individual, that the endophytes were first described by Johann Heinrich Friedrich Linck, who was a German, obviously, botanist and naturalist, who was actually responsible for a lot of discoveries kind of during his life, which was between the late 1700s through to the mid 1800s. And so the first usage that I was able to find for endophyte was in the 1830s. And yeah, this is a pretty straightforward one, but I like it because I think that it really does add to that list of the different prefixes and suffixes that we can snip off and glue into all these other words. And I think it gives you that really clean understanding of how a lot of biological terminology has these very obvious Latin roots that can all be kind of added and subtracted from each other, and it gives you a good understanding of what you're working with. A lot of, I think, good medical students and even good PhD students can do quite well on their examinations without even knowing all the vocab, so long as they know the roots of the vocab words, because you can generally just guess what they're leading to. So yeah, this is not an epiphyte. This is an endophyte, but it lives inside of a plant.
Yeah, so epi on top of and endo
epi on
inside
top
of. Yeah.
Yep. And again, not a parasite, similar to when we talked about the epiphyte, which seemed to be a surprise to a lot of people, but an endosymbiont. So usually it's a fungus, could be a bacteria, could even be algae or something like that, that lives inside the plant for part or all of its life and does not harm the plant in doing so, but usually has some sort of symbiotic relationship.
And Fight Club is still a cool idea.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And this is just added to the t-shirt, right?
You have epiphytes versus endophytes. That's the mm-hmm. that's the fight. All right.
We'll find more fighters in this fight.
So, Jay, I was thinking of getting our DNA tested to find out what our ancestry is. Should I do that?
Yeah, you should, because that means I don't have to pay for it.
Wait, neither of you have done DNA tests yet?
No, nah. we've been talking about it.
Actually, somebody donated a kit to us, and unfortunately, it was destroyed in the flood of my house.
In the flood. Oh.
It was like right because it was on my kitchen table, which got flooded.
Have you done it, Evan?
No, I have not.
Wow, so I'm the only one here. I've done both. Not both. There's a lot now, but I've done Nat Geo Genographic, and I've done the full 23andMe. So,
and did they come back with similar results?
Yeah, but Genographic is only ancestry, so that they are quite similar in the ancestry of the two. But 23andMe has some of the health stuff that Genographic doesn't look at.
Sure,
there is a lot to this. I mean, and let's not discredit the whole DNA testing, or let's not give it too much credit. We have to right now figure out like where does the truth fall and where does it become fantasy? The fact is DNA testing is significantly on the rise. We're seeing in 2017, over 7 million people just in the United States sent their DNA to a DNA testing company. Many companies today that offer the DNA testing, and when I say the DNA testing, I mean there's all different varieties of it, but many of the companies that offer some type of DNA testing can tell you a huge amount of information about your family tree, and they'll offer some will offer health advice, like what your diet should be and like how you should train to build muscle or burn fat. And some companies will even claim that you can find details about your child's future potential, you know, in big air quotes. And it gets even crazier than this. Some companies claim that they can even tell you what kind of wine that you'll like, or that you have a likelihood.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. You know, they're saying that there's, you know, markers in your DNA, blah, blah, blah. There's a company called Human Longevity, and they charge $25,000 to map a person's entire genome.
Damn, entire.
Well, that's a big deal. Yeah, to get your whole genome mapped.
It's not just the genome, though. For that money, they also do extensive blood testing. They do body imaging and other screenings in the hopes that they can find, you know, things that they can forecast to increase your lifespan. Now,
isn't that a lot of money? Full genome.
It's probably if you take all the tests that they're doing and you know compare what the cost would be to get it done at a hospital, you know, $25,000 gets spent really quick at the hospital. So I don't think $25,000 is like this ridiculous amount of money for the extent that they go through. This particular company does do like a lot of screening. They do a lot of, you know, expensive exams and tests and all that stuff. Yes, it's still a huge chunk of money that the average person couldn't afford. And look, it does seem like this is on the fringe, right? I mean, when you hear about what they're trying to do, they're trying to predict, you know, what's going to happen to you in the future. But keep in mind, it's good that companies are doing this, because this is all like setting the stage for personalized medication. And the way that we're going to achieve personalized medication is through people's, you know, one of the big key factors is going to be DNA information.
I have to disagree with you that this is a good thing. So first of all, they may not be overcharging for the tests that they are doing, but I don't know if they are or not. But let's even if we assume it that you're getting $25,000 worth of testing, you know, out of them, there's no reason to think that those tests are necessary. We've discussed this on the show before. More information is not always better. You have medical tests, especially, always have to be done in a certain context. There needs to be a pretest probability, a reason to do the test. right? And then there needs to be a post-test probability, and you need to, there needs to be some management decision that will be affected in an evidence-based way on the specific information that you're getting. And just doing a bunch of tests that we have no idea what to do with in people without any specific indication is probably a massive waste.
Are you saying this because of all the blood tests and everything combined, or are you saying that people, rich people who are genuinely curious in having their entire genome sequence shouldn't do it?
Hey, if they will get $25,000 worth of entertainment out of reading basically, an code, elaborate horoscope, go right ahead, but the idea that this is useful medically is not established. So you're saying, you're telling me that
it's the medical sheen they're putting on it that bothers you, not the pure, just I want to have access to my
genetic code. It's called longevity.com. They're claiming that this is like a useful thing to do medically. There's no reason to think, and there's no evidence that this is, that like you're better off afterwards than before. In fact, you can't even be sure that there isn't a downside. Right? Inappropriate screening tests, which is essentially what this is. This is a screening test. This is the mother of all genetic screening tests, right? You're just looking at the entire genome. When you start to get down to, because this is why you need to know what the pretest probability is, right? What's the probability of any of these particular things that you're looking for? If you don't know that, if you're just screening in the general population, the probability of any specific thing could be very low, of having any specific condition or disease or predisposition. And then you get to the point where the false positives start to outweigh the true positives, or there's so much noise that you end, if you actually do anything in response to this information, you're probably more likely to cause harm than good.
Mm-hmm. Or there's psychological harm also. Like that can be a massive problem, right? Just the worry that comes from reading your different SNPs and not being able to, have the resources or the medical help to understand, oh, that just means I have a mildly increased risk. Like seeing this genetic code does not mean I'm going to have this disease or blah, blah, blah.
But yeah, when geneticists test your DNA, they have to do genetic counseling. There's a huge ethical, guideline as to how you convey this information to people. And also, of course, the confidentiality of this information. But you can't just tell people, oh, yeah, you got a 20% chance of getting Huntington's disease or whatever. You just can't throw that at people.
Yeah.
Oh, my
God. Good luck with your life.
Is that what they do?
Well, what do they do?
Professionals never do that.
They're testing your whole genome. Either they're withholding information or they're giving you information. If they're giving you information about your genetics, are they doing it with proper genetic counseling for every single piece of information that they give you? I somehow doubt it.
And that's the other thing. Like even 23andMe, obviously they don't test your whole genome. But what they do test, they only have a handful of things on the website that are like, they have all the research around them. And they're like, this specific gene variant has a higher probability of X, blah, 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 blah. If you want to read more, click here. You should talk to your genetic counselor. And then the rest of it, you can download a raw data file, but it's just raw data. It's like up to you if you want to go into Prometheus or if you want to find a secondary company or a secondary software program and actually go through snip by snip and figure out what the different genes are.
So they're not responsible for it.
They're like, here's raw data.
Because the truth of the matter is this is so evolving to something else, but as much as I agree, Steve, with the idea of like you have to be ethical when you talk to somebody about their medical, sensitivities, I also do think people should have legally and ethically have access to their own genetic information.
Mm-hmm.
That's your body. Like if you want that information, I think it's actually effed up if we try to keep it from people.
Well, I disagree again. I disagree.
Ethically guided.
Because that's like saying you have a right to your own anatomy.
I think you do.
And therefore, somebody should provide MRI scans of you so that you can screen yourself for disease.
If you want to pay for it, you want to go get an MRI and it doesn't prevent other people from getting life-saving medicine. And then here's a bunch of images. Have fun. And then you want to hire me to help you analyze them. Yeah.
Steve, are you saying the resource is such that we shouldn't be wasting it on this sort of what you would consider, frivolous?
Well, let's take behavior. Let's take Kara's example. Let's say somebody buys an MRI scan and is offering MRI scans just so that if you want a picture of your insides, no medical context or claim or anything, we'll give you MRI pictures of your body because, you know, why not? It's a picture of your own body. We're just providing it for you. There you go. But you know people want that information because they want for the medical implications.
Sure.
Of it, right?
Yeah, so but at a certain point, I don't know. Like, it's who's the liability lie on?
It has to be considered a medical diagnostic procedure. And there's a certain ethic attached to that. So I know there's a gray zone in there. If you're saying, well, we're doing it in the context of pure entertainment. Okay, but it is basically a diagnostic test that you're doing.
Steve, is this along the same lines as the argument that people should not own their own ultrasound because basically it could cause more problems than do any good for someone who runs all these tests regularly on themselves and scare themselves basically into sickness?
There's a huge gray zone here. This is a complicated discussion because it gets very, very quickly into the liberty and rights versus professionalism and medical ethics. And, you know, obviously as a physician, I have a certain bias going into this. Obviously, people have a right to do whatever they want. Consenting adults, if they want to be dumb, they could be dumb, right? If they want to do something that's not in their own interest, we can't stop them. That's fine. That's not the same thing, though, as somebody having the right to sell them something which is ethically dubious, right? So I think you have to separate the right of the consumer from the right of the seller, of the marketer. And so if you have a company called Longevity and you're claiming that this information, we're trying to figure out how to make you live longer, and you're maybe being wishy-washy with the claims, but let's face it, we know what they're creating a market by creating the expectation that this is somehow useful in terms of you taking care of yourself, your own health. And obviously this is like the entire self-help industry kind of falls under this umbrella.
What if the company was just called Analytics and their whole thing was that they just offered you data? Like, that's more what I'm talking. At a certain point, I think in our futures, we as individual people should have access. And I think that it's ethical for us to have access to our own genetic data, because ultimately that's going to be in a database somewhere and somebody else is going to have access to it. I want to be empowered to at least have my own record on file.
Let's get it in that database as soon as possible.
There are two questions here, right? And that is, one is, do people have a right, if they want to pay for it out of their own pocket, you know, do they have the right to get access to any medical information about themselves? And again, I agree. Sure, absolutely. But then we have to consider, what are the ethics of the companies providing these services? Are they crossing over a line in terms of making any claims? Are they creating a market through any kind of fraudulent approach? But then the third question, which is really what I'm talking about, is it a good idea? And what I'm saying is, totally separate from the question of whether or not people have a right to this information, it's not medically a good idea. You know, just
which is
marketing.
Surprising. I mean, this is like, we're halfway through 2018 and you're saying that a full genomic scan is really not that helpful.
No, it isn't.
And that pisses me off. Well, what the hell? How long is this going to take?
That's not completely true, though. It's not completely
true.
That
it's not helpful?
Oh, boy.
No, it's not. Yeah. Not from the research I've been doing. I mean, there are, first of all, like, just to clarify, because my point here was that if people want to pay to get this testing done, if something satisfies them with it, you know, it's very expensive. As long as the companies are being very straightforward about how reliable the results are, then again, it is that void. It's in that zone where people, you know, should know what they're purchasing legitimately. But if they want to put the money in, I like the industry funding itself, and they are advancing every how DNA testing has advanced.
Yeah, but are they advancing anything? That's another question. You know, we need to do careful scientific research to understand the utility of every bit of information that we garner. I think it could be useful in terms of filling up data banks, you know, databases full of information.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
But who has access to that database? How is it being used? What's the quality control? We don't know any of that. Is it really useful academically, scientifically, or not? Is it just an industry collecting information for their own personal use so that they could then sell that information back to customers, which that, I think is what is actually happening.
That is happening.
Yeah. And these companies are not transparent with their databases, with their algorithms. They're using SNPs to make claims about your ancestry. We have no idea what they're doing. They're not transparent about it. So we can't even do any kind of quality control to know what the how valuable the information that we're getting from them is.
I totally agree. It's the Wild West of DNA testing. It's the beginning of a new industry. And typically, the pattern that we're seeing here with DNA testing is following the typical pattern that happens. It's like when the internet came and then all of a sudden, you know, government has to get involved, start throwing some regulations down and legitimizing everything. You know, and I get Steve's point is not a bad point. It's like, look, because we don't really know the quality, it's not worth the $25,000, and I don't disagree. But, you know, I also agree with what Kara's saying, that you can't tell people, hey, you know, as long as they're told this information, they should be allowed to spend the money if they want to. And look, there is going to be a massive amount of pseudoscience related to DNA. Just wait. This is going to be
I mean, we're already seeing it.
But we're
going to get so much worse.
Right, Kara? It's going to be an epidemic. It's going to be huge what we're going to have to deal with. So it's good for all of us to be educated about this.
Yeah, that's my point. Our job is to educate our audience about how to think about this. That unguided, you know, screening tests that don't have a specific evidence-based purpose behind them are counterproductive. They are actually could be hurt you.
Because then
you find that, oh my God, I have a predisposition for something. Should I do something about that? Maybe then you get another test and that test has false positives and false negatives. And then you and also may carry some risk. So you go down this medical misadventure rabbit hole based upon a screening test you never needed in the first place, looking for information that nobody knows what to do with. Those things don't tend to end well. Statistically, it's not a good thing. I know it's so counterintuitive because we tend to think that more information is better and how could information hurt you? But in medicine, everything is risk versus benefit. And knowing stuff has a risk to it. Looking for information, finding information, reacting to that information, everything is a risk versus benefit. And we spend a lot of time doing very careful studies, knowing when the benefits outweigh the risks. And if you don't do that and it is the Wild West and you're just sort of shooting, you know, craps and hoping for the best, chances are better that you're going to end up with a negative outcome than a positive outcome. That it's, again, it's counterintuitive as it is when you think about it, because again, we're not good at math, right? We're not good at statistics. But when you actually do the sabermetrics, you know, analysis of this kind of stuff, below a certain threshold, screening tests are counterproductive. And that's basically what this is. If you try to do it in any way in the medical realm, if you try to divorce it from that and say, this is just about your ancestry and it's for entertainment and who cares, and we're not making any, you know, claims, don't use this medically or whatever, that's fine. But clearly they're crossing that line. Clearly they are crossing that line.
Right. So yeah, the researchers are saying, hopefully this is from a trusted source, but they're saying that we could be decades away before what a lot of the claims are being made will be real.
Yeah.
So we're decades away from like them screening you and then giving you some really heavy duty, legitimate information that could change the course of your life. Yeah. But
yeah, Bob,
there are some cases, very, very low percentage, but there are some cases where you could have something that they can find that would say like, you know, you really have a marker in here that says you're going to get colon cancer. And colon cancer is extraordinarily treatable if you catch it early enough, right? If you catch colon cancer at its earliest stages, it's you know, it's a joke. It's very easy to deal with. So, you know, there are some low percentage legitimate tests here, but that doesn't mean that we should all be running out and getting the tests. I mean, I think what they do and what they want you to fully consider is your family history. That data is the most powerful data that you have. Really? Because your family history gives, you know, these are people that are genetically very similar to you. And that's a very good thing to do. You know, you have, you know, as morbid as this sounds, you know, it's good to get autopsies on family members that have died.
Mm-hmm.
They can tell you lots of stuff, you know. So if you have the money, it's worth paying for it to get it done.
But Jay, getting back to the colon cancer example, even if that's true, here's the thing you have to keep in mind. If it was a good idea, we'd be doing it. right? If the risks, if the benefits were outweighing the risk, if this was a good screening test that everybody should be getting, it would be part of standard medicine.
Well, but it's not there yet, though, Steve. I think that's the question. Like, we're talking about things that could be good in 20 or 30 years.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. If it was a good idea to do it now, we would already be doing it. Yeah.
Right. There's a sci-fi scary element to all this. And Bob said Gattaca, you know, wonderful, wonderful movie. It's aged very well, too, by the way. It's definitely worth a second watch. You know, we want to be careful because, you know, in some interpretation of reality, you could say that your DNA information is your most private information, right? It's a really, you know, it's this 6 billion pieces of information about you. Mm-hmm. And I understand people want privacy. And I think what we have to do is we have to find a way to keep it private and keep it so nothing really weird can be done with it. But at the same time, help your humanity with it, right? Like, I would donate my genetic information if there was a benefit to humanity for it. But at the same time, you know, I'd still want some of it to be held private, you know, just in case.
I feel like you got to be all in or all out. Like, basically, you know, a lot of my friends haven't done 23andMe or things like that because they don't want their info out there. And I'm like, okay, don't do it. Because, like, it's true. There is a Pandora's box that gets opened. We don't know. It's like you said, it's the Wild West. I don't know how good the laws are right now. I don't know what's slipping through the cracks. Like, if you don't want that to be an issue at all, just don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going to probably wait a little while.
Like, you have that option.
Yeah, I'll wait a little while and we'll see how things pan out over the next 5 or so years. You know, maybe they'll make it so, you know, it is on lockdown. You know, it's open to public. Like, if it's anonymous, great. Then it's fine.
That's how they do it. Everything's de-identified.
Yeah,
it has to be de-identified.
So I got a couple of other things I wanted to say. One, there's a $1,000 to $25,000 cost variance to get your whole genome sequenced with the current companies that do it today. There's three.
Oh, wait, you can do it for $1,000?
Yeah. Yep. Huh. Yep, you can do it. You can do it for $1,000, but who knows what the company is.
And you don't get all the wooey medical shit.
Yeah, I don't think they give you much. Like, they sequence it, and I don't think they're giving you a lot of, like, the, you know, analytical.
The full sequence.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's more in line with what I was thinking.
So there's three different kinds, though. Let me break it down for you. There's the, you know, sequencing a person's complete genome. There's the one where they just analyze the proteins. It's called the exome. And they sequence the protein-coding genes.
But that was the proteome.
No, this is the protein-coding genes, he said.
And this is one.
The proteome is the proteins.
This is 1% to 2% of your DNA. And apparently they could still, you know, this I think falls into that it's entertainment type thing. Like, they'll tell you things like, you know, you have this thing that makes your ear fold a certain way. You have this thing that, you know, you can wiggle your forehead or whatever, you know, like stuff like that. I didn't read anything that I was too psyched about with that. The one that the researchers are saying is, yes, it's good. Go for it. This is the small sample, the single nucleotide polymorphisms.
Snips. Yeah, the SNPs.
SNPs.
The SNPs. Now, they're saying that they can give you pretty good information about your ancestry.
Yeah, that's like what everybody, that's what DNA and Ancestry.com, they all use SNPs.
Yeah, so they do the SNPs. You can get it for relatively cheap, you know, $100 to $300. They're not going to tell you anything other than, you know, this is historically where your ancestors lived and where they came from. And a lot of people are saying that that's trustworthy. You know, it's not rock solid. Like, they can't, you know, I wouldn't do anything other than take it as, oh, that's interesting. I like that.
Well, and also a lot of it's based on the fact that, like, the data is only going to be as good as the pool, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, garbage in, garbage out. And sure. If basically all of the data, and the problem with even 23andMe, they have all this publicly available. But when you start to go through and you look at their database, it's something ungodly, like 95% white European.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that conceptually it's fine. We really don't know how well they're executing it, and there is some unreliability there. If you send it to 5 different places, you're not going to get. It'll be broadly similar, but you won't get exactly the same answers. And then some people were saying that, yeah, they're also looking at modern SNPs. But what if your ancestors came from there 1,000 years ago? It doesn't necessarily mean that they were unchanged over those 1,000 years, the SNPs. So they're extrapolating from modern populations to ancestral populations, and that may be introducing an artifact as well. So again, it's not really academic. It's just.
But it is cool. They've gotten
into
fun haplotypes.
And, yeah, yeah. So guys, in North Carolina, they passed a law that said that if you get a doctor's note, you can be exempted from having a smart meter attached to your home.
What?
Wait, what does having a doctor's note have to do with the smart meter?
Because of the supposed health effects?
Yes, because of alleged health effects.
Oh my God.
Wait, what does a smart meter do?
So a smart meter is two-way communication, right? So it hooks up to the internet and it sends more precise information about your energy consumption. Yeah, to the utility company. And you need a smart meter if you have the solar on your roof and you're sending electricity back to the grid and you need to get credit for it. You know, you need one of these meters. So I have one because I had to get an upgraded meter because I got my solar panels installed, right?
Oh, yeah. I think I get some sort of rebate if I install one for my electric car.
Right. So, and we've talked about this before, the fact that there are people claiming all the usual things, right? That it causes headaches, it causes ringing in the ear, fatigue.
A lot of
vague symptoms. For example, there's emsafetynetwork.org, which is, you know, all fear mongering about electromagnetic waves. And they say it causes fatigue, ringing in the ears, problems sleeping, headache, learning problems, heart problems, balance problems, leg cramps, eye problems. So, yeah. So anything that causes all of those things, you know, that's dubious. And then they fear monger about cell phones, and then they just sort of throw smart meters in there. But this is definitely one of those situations where just a little bit of scientific knowledge completely torpedoes any claim. So smart meters, they're claiming that they cause all of these problems because of the Wi-Fi, right? Because they use Wi-Fi to connect to the internet. But what percentage of the time are the smart meters using the Wi-Fi?
Interesting. Percent of time. 10%.
How much time of the day? How much time?
What? A minute.
I was thinking a few minutes.
1.4 seconds. Wow. 1.4 seconds.
That's my awesome. Gosh. I didn't realize 1.4 seconds could do so much damage to me, Steve.
5.3 gigawatts. So what are they? They're releasing gamma radiation?
That's what I was going to say, Bob. 1.4 seconds of gamma rays, maybe.
Highly ionized quick, particles.
And this, is, of course, something outside your house, right?
But it has a way of getting inside the house.
So it's 550 times less microwave exposure than just standing in front of your microwave oven, and 1,100 times less radiation than holding a cell phone up to your ear. So if you spend a second on the cell phone, you just got 1,100 times more non-ionizing radiation than you would if you had a smart meter attached to your house.
So that convinces them when they're told that, right?
When they're told that on their cell phones.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, right.
This is, any of you guys watch Better Call Saul?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm certainly aware of it,
that's
but I don't
watch it. That's what the brother has, right?
Yeah, the brother has this electromagnetic sensitivity. This is like, we're at that level, right? Where if you think 1.4 seconds of Wi-Fi on a device outside of your house, remember the inverse square law, you know, the farther away it is.
I mean, if those people only knew what they were really being bombarded with in everyday life, they might freak out and just crawl up into a ball or something.
We've pointed out before, non-ionizing radiation doesn't have enough energy to break bonds. And not for nothing, there's tons of studies showing that they're completely safe. So there really is no plausibility here. There's no known link. Doesn't stop groups from fear-mongering about it, and they got far enough to have a law passed. Now, it remains to be seen what will happen, because, again, you need a doctor's note. But what I suspect will happen is that you're going to get a couple of quacks who are going to cater to this crowd, and they'll be signing everybody's notes.
Sure.
Most doctors won't. I would never do that, you know, because there's no evidence to support it. But, you know, they'll probably find, you know, some quack-friendly doctor somewhere to sign the notes for them.
Steven, will this be the start of something else in which now you'll have notes to relieve your kids from attending school for those kinds of reasons, and it'll kind of maybe snowball from...
Well, I mean, that already
something bigger.
It kind of already exists. I mean, you know, there's lots of situations which you can get a doctor's note, but this is something that is connected specifically to the utility company. You know, so and the utility, the law basically says that the utility company has to abide by that. So anyway, that's just a quick update because I know we've talked about the whole smart meter thing before, but It is, I think, just an example of irrational fear-mongering about new technology. You know, oh, yeah. And this one is particularly egregious because 1.4 seconds of like cell phone exposure outside your house. That's what we're talking about. It's ridiculous. If you go out anywhere in public where people are using cell phones, you are getting bombarded with thousands of times more radiation than your smart meter.
Well, if you express it in picoseconds, it's much scarier.
Yeah, I guess so. Bob.
Yes.
I'm worried about this whole expanding universe thing. How do I keep ahead of this?
Slow down.
Well, there's some ideas. You know, well, there's short-term planning. Then there's long-term planning. Then there's really long-term planning. And this is well beyond even that. So two scientists have published two papers that speculate about what highly advanced civilizations could potentially do to survive in 100 billion years when the expansion of the universe has removed beyond our cosmic horizon everything except gravitationally bound objects. Dan Hooper is a senior scientist with Fermi National Accelerator Lab. And Abraham Loeb is a professor of science at Harvard University and the chair of the Harvard Astronomy Department. Awesome job titles for both of these awesome guys. This expansion is, of course, an inevitability of dark energy, right? Talked about it plenty of times. Space-time has a dark energy density. Every cubic centimeter, say, has a certain amount of energy associated with it. The thing is, as new space is created, the energy density stays the same because it's an inherent part of space, right? So it doesn't get thinned out like mass would be or radiation, right? As the universe expands, the mass, any mass or radiation within it gets diluted. But this does not happen with dark energy, and only dark energy behaves this way. So it's this that is really increasing the expansion rate of the universe. It's more accurate to think of it that way than something like some weird outward pressure or anti-gravity. It's really this consistent energy density that stays the same no matter how big the universe gets. As expansion increases then, and you got more space created within the universe, then obviously the distant objects are going to be more and more distant. They recede faster and faster, and they're moving away faster than light eventually. Eventually, there's so much space, there's so much intervening space between you and this galaxy, say, that even if the space is expanding not that fast, there's so much of it that it's literally expanding away from you faster than the speed of light. So, and what does that mean? Obviously, you can never see it again, and you can never reach it again. With any type of rocket engine or spaceship engine that can't go faster than the speed of light, which is probably all of them. So eventually our neck of the woods will exist only as a combination of the Milky Way, Andromeda, and the 30 or 40 or so smaller galaxies within our local group of galaxies. That's going to be our entire universe. So one good way to think about this whole thing is that imagine if our solar system, was getting bigger and bigger. And eventually doing something like making Mars so far away from us that you can't see it again, even in the most powerful telescope. And of course, you can never travel to it again. Now, so that would be devastating, of course, for space exploration and probes and even resource availability. I mean, if you're thinking of like, you know, future resources of humanity, you know, as these decades and centuries come, of course, we're going to utilize, you know, resources in the in Mars and other planetary bodies. And can you imagine? They've found asteroids that are like all like diamond or crazy crap like that. Amazing resources out there, forever accelerating away from us. But the thing is, we're not even a Type 1 civilization, right? You guys have heard the Kardashev scale of technological civilizations. Yeah. So number one is you're a planetary civilization. We're not even that. Sagan.
What does that mean?
So it means that you can use and store all of the energy associated with your planet. So then Type 3, that's a galactic civilization. Essentially, the idea is that they can control energy on the scale of an entire host galaxy. So this is the type of civilization we're talking about here. So a civilization that's been around long enough where they are that powerful. So what could they do to deal with this type of situation? So Hooper envisages such a society traveling to other galaxies, actually going there and bringing stars back to use as a power source. So it's basically,
okay,
let's go all the way over there and grab those big batteries and bring them back, and we'll use them when we really need them. Now, of course, if you think about that for a second, the masses would have to be within a certain range. You can't, you know, you have to get a star that has a mass high enough that it produces enough energy for you to be interested, but low enough mass star so that it doesn't supernova on the way home, right? In a few million years. Mm-hmm. Because in a few million years, you know, that's a tiny little step towards 100 billion years. That's nothing. So he said something like you would look for 0.2 solar mass stars and up to 1 point solar, you know, a solar mass star. Now, the interesting thing about this is that he calculates that this stellar harvest could extend within a region of space extending out 30 megaparsecs and in radius. So that's huge. I mean, it's a million parsecs. A parsec is little over three light years.
Bob, how much time is that?
Oh my God. So if you could basically harvest the stars within this huge radius around you or you know, wherever you are, then he detects that you can increase your future energy stores by a factor of several thousand. So that's his angle on this. And he even says, hey, by the way, you know, since this would take millions and billions of years to actually pull this galactic scale engineering off, there might be civilizations that are doing this right now that we could detect. So he says that, well, you know, maybe in the future we'll have sensitive detectors enough where we could actually detect what it would take, the energy required to transport a star millions, you know, basically millions of light years back home to this alien civilization. Or he says perhaps, you know, we could look into some galaxies and detect like, hey, this galaxy has very, very few low mass stars. It's essentially missing all the stars that such a civilization would kind of hijack and take back to their home and use that as kind of evidence of what's happening. So
I have a question. So,
yeah, what do you got?
Bob, if you had that sort of technology, wouldn't it be more efficient to just go to the star instead of moving it?
You
build an artificial planet or something around it.
Well, yeah,
put it into orbit and you're done.
That's exactly what Abraham Leb had that exact idea. He said that, he has a problem with Hooper. He's like, well, hey, wait a second. Even if you get a good sized star and you bring it over here, it could still turn into a white dwarf in a billion years. And that's still not even close to this nasty time ahead. Now, the low mass stars, say 0.2 solar masses, they could last half a trillion years. So that's, even though it's not a lot of energy compared to the big boys, it's still a battery that could last you a really, really long time. So what he says is don't bring the stars here. Just go to them. Go to the stars.
That's right.
So he thinks that all the cool civilizations won't be bringing the stars to them, but they're going to be moving to the stars. Emigrating sounds better, you know, as long as families don't get split up in the process, of course. But so all you have to do is find these dense nearby clusters and go there. And sure, it could take a billion years, but hey, you're a type 3 civilization. Just deal with it. You know, you could do this thing. So Leb says, for example, if we were in this situation, 50 million light years away in the Virgo cluster contains 1,000 times the mass of our Milky Way. So if we were, you know, if we were a type 3 civilization, we, you know, might want to consider going there. And because we would have lots of, lots of this mass available to us to use. So the bottom line then, the idea for Leb is to get yourself near as many stars as possible so you can do things like surround them into Dyson swarms to capture every erg of energy that they pump out and then store them and use them so that during the lean times in 100 billion years when there's really not that much mass in your neighborhood, far less than now, that you could use it to kind of extend your civilization. But eventually you're just extending the inevitable. The heat death of the universe is going to happen. But it's an interesting idea, the strategies that civilizations might need to take in order to survive as long as they can, you know, to find that energy gradient, before there's no more gradients and everything is just entropy is at maximum. And then basically all life and all time just essentially stops.
Yeah. I hate it when that happens.
when you say that time stops, what is that? How does time stop?
Yeah, well, do you mean time stops for life or no, time stops actually?
At maximum entry, with nothing, think about it. Time is – one way to look at time is time exists because of entropy, because there's a huge difference between entropy at one end and the other end, right? There's a huge difference, and that essentially is where time comes from. So when you reach maximum entropy – and everything is disorganized. It's all like low grade heat, unusable heat. Nothing can happen because there's no gradient of energy that could be used to do anything like think or metabolism
or watch porn on your computer. None of that stuff's going to happen because there's no temperature, there's no energy gradients. So it's in a very, very real sense, time stops because there's nothing going on. That's the heat death. That's the downside to the heat death. No intelligence is going to survive that, as far as we know, unless there's some crazy stuff that they could eventually do. But you always have the hope of, some amazingly random conglomeration or improbability of virtual particles.
You did not answer my question.
Galaxy, a new universe, huh?
You didn't answer my question.
Sure, I did.
What I'm trying to say is, if theoretically you had a stopwatch that could run forever,
but that you're breaking the premise. The stopwatch would stop because there'd be no energy differential to run it.
And that's not even because there wouldn't be any time, although there wouldn't be anything.
No, there could be stuff. There's just you could have physical stuff wouldn't continue. But it couldn't do anything.
Exactly.
Inert.
There'd be no change to it. There'd be no processes.
All right, Carrie, you're going to tell us about this new study looking about why some people are alcoholics.
Yeah, this is really interesting because I think it has a lot of layers, and a lot of those layers speak directly to some themes that we often cover on the show. So, we've been speaking about addiction a little bit lately. We've definitely talked a lot about animal models and mouse models and why sometimes they can be incredibly problematic for behavioral research and for medical research. And I think this is kind of a really interesting study because it touches on a lot of these things. So the long and short of it is that researchers have often gone about studying addiction using mice. You guys all remember the send up of like a mouse pressing a little bar and getting like a jolt of cocaine or something like that.
This is
a common thing. Yeah. And this has been the model for a long time. Like, give a mouse the option to do coke or to not do coke. The mouse will choose to do coke. He'll keep pushing the bar. He'll keep getting coked up, and eventually it'll be to his detriment. Like, he'll stop eating or he'll have some sort of other horrible behaviors. And then that's always been a model for human addiction behavior. But, this piece that was written up in The Atlantic by Ed Yong, it's actually about a paper that was recently published in Science just this last week, called A Molecular Mechanism for Choosing Alcohol Over an Alternative Reward. And it's by Augier, I think is his last name, the researcher. Maybe I'm not pronouncing that appropriately, but I think it's Augier. And the interesting thing here is that the question has always been, why is it that we study these behaviors in mice and then we figure out what's going on in their brain and then we develop some sort of clinical treatment that should work and then we try it on people and then it always fails? Like, this has happened so many times in history. There's some sort of breakthrough in the mouse brain. Oh my gosh, we figured something else out that's new. And then we tried it on people and it didn't work on people. And they started to realize that maybe we've been going about this the wrong way, because we've always been looking at these animals where 100% of the population is addicted. But that's not how addiction works in human beings. Everybody has had alcohol in their lives, but not everybody gets addicted to alcohol, right? Only about, seems like the number is somewhere around 15% of people who drink actually have an alcohol addiction problem.
Huh.
That's of drinkers. It's like, that means 85% of people who drink alcohol just do it socially and don't have a problem with it. It doesn't interfere with their daily lives. They know when to stop. They don't drink so much that they black out, whatever your defining features are. So why is it that what we're doing is we're taking these species of mice and we're getting them all hooked on alcohol or drugs or whatever the case may be, and then we're looking at their brains and being like, this doesn't translate. And so what they realized is that if they give these mice an option, not just, push the bar, get the cocaine, and go crazy, but, and also historically, if you give mice alcohol, they'll always choose to drink alcohol over water. And then
what?
They'll
really?
Yeah. Totes. Like, they love the alcohol. It's the same thing with the cocaine. They'll choose cocaine over food. And so, they love the alcohol, they'll drink it. And then it's like, oh crap, all these mice are addicted to alcohol. That's what we wanted. We do stuff with their brains. And then we're like, this doesn't translate. We cannot figure out how to do a human trial. The drugs that we're developing, they aren't reacting. Like, humans aren't responding. So they were like,
Don't we get humans addicted to alcohol and then cut up their brains?
Yeah, let's totally do that. Seems pretty ethical. So that's one approach. They did something a little bit more ethical, which is that they gave mice in the cage the option. If they push this bar or whatever the administration technique was, then they get alcohol. If they go over to this trough, Then they get sugar water. It's better than water.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's something that they want. It's sweet. It has good stuff in it. Hey, guess what? 15% of the mice went for the alcohol.
Uh-oh.
They all tried it. They all liked it. 15% of the mice were like, I'm going to choose the alcohol over the sugar water. There's something about this that's really doing it for me. And they became addicted. And they're like, weird. So then they started to look at the brains of the mice that like the alcohol over the mice that like the sugar water. And there are all these target points in the brain that have always been implicated in addiction. And people have been studying them for ages and ages and ages. But what they realized is that of, I think, five targets that they looked at, only one of them had a difference between this small percentage of mice who went for the alcohol over the larger percentage of mice who chose the nectar, the sweet water. And they're like, that's interesting. Let's start to look at this brain region. And of course, this brain region was in the amygdala, which is usually implicated in like emotions and emotion research. Oh, sorry. It wasn't 4 out of 5. It was 5 out of 6 regions that they usually look at, genes in these different regions that have always been implicated. And so they were like, oh, okay. So what's going on in the amygdala? You guys have heard of the amygdala, right? Like the almond, it's named
part
for the
of
the almond.
Brain. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the amygdala is interesting because, you know, this is the part of the brain where when you stimulate it, like you get the cat reflex, like where the cat's hair stands straight up and they're like, I'm angry. And so you can like make cats angry immediately by stimulating their amygdala. And so it seems to be implicated in a lot of things having to do with like reactions and like deep, strong kind of, you know, basal emotions. The amygdala has a neurochemical, a neurotransmitter. So what GABA does is it actually quiets neurons and it tells them to stop firing. And there are lots of enzymes that are involved in these GABAergic systems. These researchers targeted a specific enzyme called GAT3, and GAT3 pumps excess GABA back into the cell so that they can reuse it. These rats had really effed up levels. Like they had a gene that made their GAT3 less active, so their pump wasn't working. So they had all this GABA that was accumulating outside of the neurons, and so all the neurons were really depressed. They were abnormally inactive compared to the neurons in the other animals. And they think that this could be a really interesting finding because there was a French cardiologist who once claimed that he was an alcoholic, and that he cured his alcoholism by taking a drug called baclofen. And like nobody really believed him. There wasn't any good data or science as to why baclofen would have worked back then. But now we know that the way baclofen works is it prevents neurons from releasing GABA. And so they're seeing that there's some correlates there. But the problem is baclofen is actually really addictive. And a lot of studies have shown that it hasn't been as effective as they've hoped. But if the actual mechanism that we're talking about in these rats translates to a similar mechanism, even in some people who struggle with alcoholism, and we can find a genetic variant that then downstream we can develop drugs to help work around, this could be a really good model, A, for human alcoholism, and it could potentially lead to some good outcomes. Because apparently, just looking at a lot of the data, alcoholism has been like an albatross. It's just been a really difficult thing for addiction researchers, both psychologists, neurologists, neuroscientists, pharmacologists. They've always really struggled with alcoholism. They haven't been able to come up with a good model. They haven't been able to translate animal models to human studies very readily. And then most of the work that they're doing in human studies is not very helpful. And so I like this paradigm shift, this idea that like, it's not just that once somebody's exposed to alcohol, they're going to become an alcoholic. All we've got to do is block the exposure of the alcohol, which has historically been the way that we've tried to treat these things. There's something happening in a small percentage of people where they get addicted when other people don't.
It's interesting. But what I found ironic was the setup for the piece was that, oh, we've done all this research in rats showing what happens in the brain when they get addicted. And then we try to translate that to humans and then it fails. And then now this time we have another model in rats showing what happens in the brain. And this time it's really going to work. You know, it's like,
I think that you're right. But I think that what they're trying to say is, no, before what we did is we made all the rats addicted and then we wondered why it didn't work.
Yeah, but again, it's just another hypothesis.
It is. Yeah, for sure.
They're still at that same point where they haven't, and they maybe they're missing something else. Because you know what? Human brains and rat brains are different.
Are very different.
Just a little.
And they probably are missing something else. But I think the reason that it made a lot of people's ears perk up is because naturally the percentage was appropriate.
But
they did a small study.
A lot of, you know.
Yeah, who knows?
15%, 50%, that's, I don't know, that's pretty speculative still. And that anecdote about the guy with the baclofen, okay, but it's still, it's very thin. It's very thin and it's reasonable and, you know, it may turn out to be correct. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. It's just that I just found it funny that they just made the same exact mistake that they were, you know, saying that everyone else made before them, but just assuming it's going to translate to humans.
It's what we do in the sciences because we know. Do what we know.
You keep kicking that football. Yeah. I know. But the other thing is about the 15%, is that really universal across different populations? Because, you know, my understanding is that different nationalities of people have different rates of alcoholism based upon their historical use of alcohol in their culture.
Yeah, but now that I'm looking at these other – I was just looking at some other indications and the numbers are much lower. I don't think it's that 15% of the population is an alcoholic. I think it's that 15% of individuals who are exposed to alcohol develop a problem with it.
Yeah, but still, my point is that there may be a genetic difference in different populations because of historical experience with alcohol in the culture.
That's such an important point because I think take that argument and compare it to almost everything we always talk about is that we do have medical science, at least in the West, has a very strong male Euro bias and always has. And we're starting to see change. But most of the data in most of the databases in existence were studies done on white men.
Yeah.
Like only I think in the 80s was there a federal law passed that said that the NIH had to include women in their study populations.
Yeah, well, they excluded women because they didn't want the complication of pregnancy. Wow. No, seriously, it was like, oh, we don't want to accidentally do research on pregnant women, so we'll just exclude all women from the study.
Yeah, 51%.
And obviously, then that's not a good idea. A drug goes to market, and of course, they're not like, this is a man's only drug. And then the drug has literally never been tested on women. You know?
Right. In the last 10, 15 years, it's the same sort of thing came up with kids. Like, we're giving kids drugs we've only tested in adults. You know, maybe we should test it in kids.
Oh, boy.
And now I think we're starting to understand, hey, maybe we should test these drugs in different ethnic populations because they have different genetic sensitivities and different cultural sensitivities.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah, of course.
It's like doing psychological studies on college students, you know. And
I know. Not they're all on college students.
Yeah, I know. It's a sample of convenience, as we call it.
It actually is called that in the public case.
I know.
It's a convenience sample of, I love it. It's so funny.
Yeah, lazy sample. Okay.
Exactly.
Jay.
Yeah.
Who's that noisy?
The I wasn't doing anything else sample.
Yeah, the shooting fish in a barrel sample.
Got nothing better to do.
They are going to do it for class credit sample.
I get a free sandwich sample.
Last week, I played this noisy.
Pew, pew.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's a blaster noisy.
Yeah, it's a blaster.
Is it the guy tapping the telephone wires to generate the noise, like with a screwdriver?
Is ice involved in that sound in any way?
Oh, ice. Interesting. Or metal.
I think that's metal.
That's a hot idea, Steve. No, of course not. It's not ice. Ice.
Is it a spring?
You're way cold.
No, Steve. It's not a spring.
Okay. It's a telephone wire.
No, Evan. God.
God, Evan.
Am I closer than ice?
Let me help educate you guys a little bit.
All right, set us straight.
Andrew Barry thinks that this sounds like a Martian ship's scanner from the old film version of War of the Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
He's right. It does sound like that. I looked it up. I listened to it. There is a little bit of that in there. He's right. But that's not what it was.
It's not that. I am intimately familiar with that exact noise because I've seen that movie 100 times.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of it in there.
It's a little bit, but it's not it.
No, it's not it, but I'm going to get right to the notable guest of the week. This comes from Evil Eye, and he says, it sounds like railroad spikes being pulled and the rail ricocheting, and he thinks it was sped up. The echo is from the surrounding foliage. That's not correct, but there is something correct about it. The winner, and Evan, this is like such an inside joke for most of us here on the SGU. Kara did not play City of Heroes with us. But this next guy signed his email, and this is the guy who won. Wolfie.
Did he really?
Yeah, now I don't know if he knows that, that's a joke between all of us. His real nickname. But
Evan,
I would love
Jay, you drop it at least once a show every week.
Knows? But see, you don't understand. Like, I don't know 100% what makes it into the show or not. Even though I listen to the show, I confuse.
You do? Can't listen to the show. We just recorded it. We spent 3 hours recording. I'm not also going to listen to it.
So I have to listen to it. I have to because I'm one of the producers of SGU Productions, and I have to know what made it to the air. But I do admit I confuse the finished show versus like our version.
Raw versus. Yeah, like, versus
Steve, so how often would you say Wolfie is in an episode?
Wolfie.
Welcome to Strigo, Wolfie. It's in the show. So I also loved that this guy's, I guess it was the name that he put in when he wrote to Who's That Noisy? He put in, "Don't spam me, bruh." that's like his email where he's like, "You can't write me back" email address. You know what I mean? So he said, "Hello to everyone at the Skeptics Guide. I'm a relatively new listener to the show and I've been enjoying it for a few months now. At any rate, I have a guess about this week's noisy. This week's noisy sounds very similar to the sound effect imagined and produced to represent the sound of a laser gun being fired in science fiction." He's right. But that said, I'm going to guess that its sound is produced in a similar manner, a metal cable being struck with a mallet or other sturdy tool, such as those used to anchor posts that support overhead power lines.
Right.
Now, I'm going to give it to him because of how close this is to the actual noisy. He is a 95% winner. Yes, it is metal being struck by something very hard, and it's making that. But what it actually is, and I'll remind you that Morgan Loveless sent this noisy in, and Morgan is a railway worker, and Morgan said, "I work on the railway and we are doing some new construction. We have rails that are 2,000 feet long that we are moving into place on top of the plates on the ties. The first and third sounds, I edited it, so you're only hearing one of the sounds. He's hitting the rail on the side with a hammer. And he also then, another noise he makes, he hits the end of the rail. The one that you heard is him hitting, I believe it's the side of the rail with a hammer, and that is 2,000 feet of reverberation."
Neat.
Yes. And he sent me a follow-up email, and he said, "FYI, I am a man from British Columbia, Canada."
Morgan.
Kara. He's a man.
Okay, I'm just saying. It's good to know.
I know. But maybe you should trust my gut next time.
He identifies as male.
Yes. There's a woman in my gym named Morgan, and she was the first person on my – I think the only Morgan I know is a woman. Do you know any men named Morgan?
Morgan Freeman?
Yeah, Morgan Freeman.
I know Morgan Loveless.
There's Morgan from Morgan from The Walking Dead.
No, people you know personally, Evan.
Captain Jack Morgan.
Actually, Kara, I do. A guy named Morgan was the manager of and co-owner of a music store I went to for 20 years.
Yeah, so I wonder if the reason your head immediately went to Morgan being male and mine immediately went to Morgan being female is because those are the Morgans.
Sure, I agree.
Yeah,
better the Morgan you know than the Morgan you don't.
But the interesting point, though, is, I mean, it is a you know, something that we all do. Like, we have these preconceptions in our head. Like, I figured that Morgan was a man because he was a railway worker, because I read the email. I knew that he worked on the railway. And he's talking about 2,000 feet of some of the heaviest crap that people...
Oh, and you couldn't tell us that because you couldn't give away what...
Yes, of course. Yes. So, understood. But he's a man, man. That was a great sound. I want to play that noisy again just so you guys can hear how awesome it is now that you know what it is.
Yeah.
Wow.
And now that you hear that, can you visualize...
Yeah.
The wave of energy going 2,000 feet back, 2,000 feet back, 2,000 feet back. You know what I mean? Just gets super fast. I love that. I wonder how fast that reverberation was passing through that 2,000 feet. Like, at what speed was it going? You know, it wasn't going the speed of sound through the air at sea level, right? It was probably much slower.
No, faster.
It is faster.
Sound
right.
will travel faster through steel than it will through the air.
You're right. I forgot that. You're totally right. I have a new noisy for you guys.
Yay.
This noisy was sent in by Adam Rufa. And my only clue will be that Adam and his 12-year-old daughter are involved with this noisy. And there you have it.
That's that toy, which is a a pole and a kind of this dome with a bunch of balls. And as you drive, roll it around on the carpet, it pops the balls and within the dome.
I know exactly what that sound is because I owned one of those. Should I say that or no?
You could say that. That's fine. All right. If you think that you know this week's noisy, and I'm talking to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
You guys never email me, by the way. I wonder why.
Like, we don't email you?
Yeah, you could always email Who's That Noise to say hi to me.
We don't even email you when you're like, email me back.
Lisa. So listen.
That's really a thing. I thought you made it up.
Bob, well, wait, Evan, that didn't come from something. We did make that up.
Lisa?
No, the Wolfie thing. Wolfie. We made that up. We did.
I thought that was from Amadeus.
No.
She calls him that.
Yes.
She calls him Wolfie in the movie.
Yeah, but we don't express it like that.
Because of that. That's not our...
That's
not our genesis.
It's because of the werewolves in...
And Striga Island.
Because it was Striga. Because you know what? In the beginning...
You had to kill 200 of these wolves to earn the Silver Slayer badge. So you were on there for hours and hours killing wolves. So after a while, everything was Wolfie. There's more Wolfie.
The things you guys do for fun is so beyond.
Yeah, but we talked... Yeah, but it was
remember
like
the badge you earned when you killed 200 of those
Kara,
bastards.
You know how we love to talk? All we would do is make each other laugh and talk while we're playing the game. It was a blast.
The reason why we do it in a
really bad German kind of American accent is because there used to be something called the Fifth Column.
Yes, a group of bad guys,
and they were Nazi-esque. So that we thought that the wolves. I think the wolves in City of Heroes were related to the Fifth Column.
They were Fifth Column. Enemies.
So they were German. They were German Nazi wolves, and that's why we started doing that. Yes.
They were Nazi werewolves. That's what they were.
That's exactly.
You got to make something extra scary and also totally morally justified to murder.
Yes,
just
of course.
Give it an SS badge.
And here's a kicker. City of Heroes changed them. They stopped calling them the Fifth Column because apparently they were getting complaints by someone saying, you know, too Nazi-ish and too, you know, a little too close to the edge for some people.
Too on the nose.
Yep.
Interesting.
So if you think you know this week's Who's That Noisy, or if you just want to say hi or send me a cool noise that you heard, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right. Just one email this week. This email comes from Chris. And Chris writes, love your podcast for the most part, but... from time to time, you do exhibit a bit of American exceptionalism. I've been away traveling and I'm catching up on some old episodes and you were talking about your book. There's a separate edition for UK and other English-speaking markets outside North America. For some reason, Kara laughed about Britain needing more U's. This is not the first time that you joke about Britain being different, which isn't exactly friendly. There are a few problems with that. Then he goes on to explain why the British spell color with a U and rumor with a U because it's based on the French, and why they drive on the left, and why...
why they eat beans on toast. We can't help ourselves, Steve. By the way, I love beans on toast. British breakfast is legit my favorite breakfast.
And then also, he dings us for like using the traditional system rather than the metric system.
He was saying that that's why books often have to be translated for the British, not translated, but they have a different printing. But that's more of like it's a different country and they make money a different way kind of a thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like we own the publishing industry here, so screw you. You're making a whole new book for us.
Why they are doing a separate printing in the UK?
Why publishers always do that. Like not just for our book,
I just think it's always their business model. So there's a British,
exactly.
They just have their different distribution, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually
because they need to add use.
No,
and terms like jolly good.
But he was saying they have to translate the English system to the metric system. But in England, don't they? It's like a weird hybridization. Some things are metric and some things are imperial still.
Right.
We so got like, that from you.
Chris finishes to please lay off the Brit bashing. He says, I know there's no hostility behind it, but the joke is wearing a little thin. Thanks again. Keep up the good work. So thanks for writing, Chris. You did the email back and forth with Chris just to explain things. So obviously this is all for humor. And I know that saying it's for humor doesn't mean that we're totally off the hook if we are, in fact, you know, using stereotypes or being unfair or whatever. But honestly, so there's a couple of misconceptions in there. So first of all, marveling at how another culture is different is not the same as implying that our culture is better, right? Mm-hmm. And, and if we do sometimes say, like, oh yeah, you have to spell it the correct way. We always say it like that because obviously one is not correct or wrong. They're just culturally different and we're being ironic. And I know that's saying we're being quote unquote ironic could be a cop out too, but we listen, we obviously, for the record, we're not saying that the idiosyncrasies of American culture are in any way superior to the idiosyncrasies of other English speaking cultures. Or non-English speaking cultures, it's just different, and we are just trying to be funny and ironic. But also, like some of the things, like talking about the metric system, we actually have made a specific effort on the show, and I don't know if you've noticed this, to always include metric units when we are talking about things. We give the miles and the kilometers, and you know what I mean, right?
Yes, but you still hate Celsius.
Kelvin.
I don't hate Celsius. I don't. Celsius is fine. And for scientific reasons, Celsius is the one to use. My only point is that it's not inherently metric and it's not inherently better for the environment. We're talking about temperature, but any, you know, of the air outside. But anyway, that's a minor point. We do think that we do try to be international. That's the thing. And we do try to, you know, give units in international units whenever possible. I specifically years ago changed the dating convention on our files to the international dating convention from the American one.
Oh, that's smart, actually.
Yeah. It actually does sort better when you do it that way.
Because we're the
it
ones does, who do that. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like when we talk about things like normal and abnormal,
month,
like
date,
the
year,
right way and
that?
Backward, yeah. Like it's really a function of everybody else does month, day, year. And America's idiosyncratic in that way.
Yeah.
But most countries drive on the right side of the road. Only British colonies drive on the left side of the road. And there's only a handful of them across the world. So just in terms of sheer numbers, it's the idiosyncratic thing. But either way, there's no right or wrong.
It doesn't matter.
And yeah. The truth is our relationship with England is very different than, like, you know, this isn't like a country. We have we are British. Like we're a British colony first, and then we fought for independence. And it's the special relationship.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's probably the culture or the country that has the closest culture to American culture across the globe, except some other British colonies, right? Like maybe I find a lot of very similar cultural things when I visit Australia, and Canada, of course, too.
So it's funny, and I wrote Chris back. I thought of something that I expressed to him. I said, my hypothesis is that it's fascinating because in a way it's in the cultural uncanny valley.
Yeah.
Because it's an English speaking
like an alternate universe.
It is. Yeah. It's like bizarro world.
Bizarro
it's world. So similar and yet it's just a little off. Everything's just a little different. And yeah. So like when you're in a foreign country that doesn't speak English, like we were in Austria, in Vienna, you expect everything to be completely foreign because it's a different language. It's a completely different culture. But like when we were in Australia and the UK and New Zealand, it's kind of the same. It's just a little, everything's just a little different. And so it's weird. I do think it's like an uncanny
rice bubbles.
Interesting perspective. Well, I like
so
it.
I dated a guy for a while who was a British guy that was like, I don't know. I met him at a hostel. It was a time in my life. But anyway, he was really, his favorite thing when he was here was to go to American grocery stores and just laugh at all the packaging.
Yeah, I get that.
Because it was so weird.
We
to
did
him.
That in Australia.
Yeah, he's like, why does your toilet paper have a bear butt on it? And I'm like, it's a whole thing. You don't understand.
Marketing.
And it's the name. And when I'm in England, I'm always laughing because everything has cutesy names. That you're right. It's just because it's so similar.
Mm-hmm.
And we even see it a little in America because America's huge, right? Like I think a lot of people forget when we go to other countries and we're like, we can just drive through multiple countries. This is so strange. But even if you go from like a really like, you know, Portland, Maine down to like Midland, Texas, there are massive cultural differences.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, of course.
And certain things make you laugh a lot. But because of American commerce, the products all look the same. They all have the same names. There's a McDonald's everywhere. Well, there's McDonald's all over England, too.
Yeah, but there are some regional differences. Like there are, you do, like if you go far enough south, I mean, you lived in Texas, so you know, but like if you grew up in New England, you get used to all the New England businesses, and then you go south and you're like, and there's some weird ones down there too that seem quaint.
And there's the ones that are the same thing.
Publish.
Some of them are the same.
Like Piggly Wiggly?
Yeah, like Piggly Wiggly. What the hell? Piggly
Wiggly. Kroger? Also, what the heck is a Kroger?
Oh, yeah. That's yeah, because it's Kroger there. And here it's Vaughn. No. What's Kroger here? Ralph's on the West Coast.
Oh, you do have a Ralph's.
Yeah, Ralph's is all over the West
Coast.
That was
just a Big Lebowski thing. It's a real thing,
no, and,
huh?
Yeah, because that's the thing, too. Movies are mostly shot here. So a lot of references you see in movies are very California. So when you visit California, you're like, oh, all these references. And so I don't feel it as much. I don't feel as separated when I watch media because it's mostly centered here. But the South, you're right, has weird, weird stuff. But what I was going to say is, like, when we're quote-unquote poking fun and we're like, hello, governor, and being ridiculous yeah, like that. We're obviously taking a stereotype and caricaturing it the same way that a lot of people are like, yeah, down there in America. Yeah. But that America. Doesn't offend America. Me.
Yeah, we make fun of ourselves.
Oh, gosh.
Just as much.
Yeah, like that doesn't offend you guys every when people day. Do that, right?
No, no, of course not. Not at all.
No. It's true.
Have, yeah, I work
because yeah, there's kernels of truth all over this.
Because hello, American politics.
Ugly
right now.
American.
Because of this podcast, we have friends all over the world, and we speak openly about the politics, and there's a lot of discussion around that. We get people saying very harsh things about America all the time. I agree with a lot of it, and I think it's perfectly fine. You know, but really. And this is – I'm not speaking for the SGU when I say this, but I just like accents and I like to joke around about accents. I love – that comedy to me is gold,
Oh, yeah.
Like somebody – I think part of – one of my favorite all-time styles of humor is British humor. It's
I love British humor.
Yeah.
We grew up on Benny Hill.
Yeah.
Oh, Benny Hill, Monty Python. My gosh. Couldn't get enough of it.
Let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. All right. Kara's trying to bounce back from her solo loss last week.
Oh, God, don't remind me.
I just did, too late.
Thank you.
Here we are, three news items. Are you guys ready?
Here we go.
Item number one, a report indicates cases of the new 7 Tesla MRI scan now coming into clinical use, pulling amalgam fillings out of teeth. Item number two, a new study finds that implementation of mandatory labeling laws in Vermont was associated with a decrease in opposition to genetically modified food of 19%. And item number three, scientists report that in a real-world test, subjects were only willing to pay half as much for merchandise as they indicated they would be willing to pay in a survey.
Huh.
Evan just volunteered to go first.
Hi-yo.
Wait, that was Bob.
Yeah. Nice try. Go ahead, Ev.
The new 7 Tesla MRI. Now with a new feature, pulling your fillings out at the same time.
The power.
I mean, hopefully they're able to modulate that so that that doesn't happen. I mean, sure, it might be capable of doing it, but, obviously that can't happen. Powerful enough to do it? I don't see why not. Sure. The next one, a study finding that implementation of mandatory labeling laws in Vermont associated with a decrease in opposition to genetically modified food of 19%. I don't see how these two things go hand in hand and have that sort of correlation. If anything, I think it might embolden people to dig their heels in more against genetically modified food. So I'm thinking this one's going to be the fiction. But let's have a quick look at the last one. A real-world test in which subjects were only willing to pay half as much for merchandise as they indicated they would be willing to pay in a survey. I'm not surprised. The psychology at play here is probably a big thing, especially when it comes to people and their idea of prices. What's a fair price? What's not a fair price? And also our tendencies to sort of state one thing yet act differently. And there's, humanity is replete with those sorts of actions. So I'm going with the mandatory labeling laws. I think that one is definitely going to be the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
People willing to pay half as much for merchandise as they – yeah, I mean that's human psychology, I think. That doesn't seem out of whack. The mandatory labeling in Vermont, that one's – I see that a little differently, Evan. I see that as like – that's like a major battle and then once you win it, people, I could see people just being like, oh, whatever. Or they buy a product and they see that it has GMO labeling and they're like, wait, this is just what I've been eating for years and it's totally fine and it looks totally normal. Oh, it's bullshit. There's nothing wrong with that. So I can kind of see that. So the first one here with the MRI scans, pulling fillings out of the teeth. I don't know how they would miss that in the testing. I mean, to me, that's like an obvious thing. Like, make sure it can't pull the fillings out. And on top of it all, are they even magnetic? I don't think they're really even affected by an MRI, any type of MRI magnetic field. But so I'll say that one's fiction.
All right, Kara.
Scientists report that in a real-world test, subjects were only willing to pay half as much for merchandise as they indicated they would be willing to pay in a survey. I mean, I guess, yeah, there's a response bias that's like you want to – like a favorable response bias where you want to like seem more blah than you are. So maybe that one is that like people want to seem richer in surveys than they are. I could also see it going – the other way, which is like that, you know, we're consumers. And so I could see myself saying one thing, being like, oh, I'd never pay more than X for something. And then when faced with the choice and realizing that X costs more, that I would be like, well, I need it or I want it. So I am going to pay the extra money. So that one kind of bugs me because I feel like you could have just flipped it. And then that would be the fiction. I think that the second thing Bob said about the GMOs was what I was agreeing with, which is that, or what was what I was thinking previously, which is that if you label GMOs, maybe it does have the outcome that people oppose them less because they realize everything on the shelves has GMOs in it if it has corn or soy or sugar beets in it. When people realize, well, crap, I've been eating GMOs my whole life and I love my like Kraft mac and cheese and I don't want to stop eating it. I don't know if Kraft mac and cheese has GMOs. Sorry to use a label, but you know,
all cheese is GMO pretty much.
Oh, well, you're right in the truest sense, but it's not transgenic, right? That's a whole other conversation. Anyway,
it might be. Yeah, they use yeast to make rennet, which normally would be in a calf's stomach, and that is what you make cheese out of.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
But they give exemption to cheese because otherwise all cheese pretty much would be
GM. Yeah. So anyway, I think that's the thing. I think people are going to realize it. So I think that one's science, and I kind of agree with Bob on the MRI thing, only because, yes, I understand that like there might be a cutoff level where the magnet is so strong that it's pulling things that it used to not pull. Yes, so that one would have to be the fiction. I don't think that MRIs are literally pulling people's fillings out of their teeth.
All right, and Jay.
I'll take these in reverse order. So the one about the real-world tests where subjects were only willing to pay half. So I agree with that because in my e-commerce profession, you got to be careful about the data that you get from surveys because the conversion isn't actually happening, which means the person isn't actually clicking the buy button. They're not putting in their credit card information and making that decision. And psychology could be very different when you're just asked a question versus actually clicking the button that's going to charge your credit card. The one here about the mandatory labeling, you know, I was always, even though I was against mandatory labeling on principle, I didn't think it was going to have a big effect. I didn't think people were going to like read that and freak out. I'm happy to hear this if it's true, because then, you know, the whole labeling thing isn't going to be an issue at all, which is great. And I'm agreeing with Kara on it for a number of reasons. One, you know, they have to test these MRI machines like crazy. You know, they know that they have to be extraordinarily careful when it comes to anything being affected by the very powerful magnets that are being used. You know, that field of magnetism could be deadly, you know, in the wrong circumstances. So they have to be super cautious, and they know that people have fillings. So I don't think that fillings were being pulled out of people's heads that way. I really don't think that was happening. And I agree with Kara. It was probably something else going on, something, you know, probably less teeth pulling. Yeah, like let's say like they just drill a hole through. Yeah, they put a magnet in.
You know,
they put like something that's magnetic, and then they have this strong magnet, and they just pull the tooth out that way instead of putting that machine in your mouth. You know, they have like this wrench they put in your mouth.
But yeah,
but you have to drill the tooth.
Look, this is just a theory here.
Wouldn't you rather just get it pulled out with the wrench thing?
Well, I know a lot of dentists, and I'm trying to throw them some ideas that you never know.
I don't think that's a good idea, Jay.
I like to use an ice skate and a rock.
Tom Hanks.
All right.
So I'm going to go with Kara, and I'm going to say, no, this does not happen to the teeth because I'm a tooth expert.
Which means you're, which really means you're going with Bob.
Well, it's a good thing Carol went with Bob, right?
Is that what you're saying?
72% of the time, Bob.
We'll start with the third one, since you all agree with that scientist report that in a real-world test, subjects were only willing to pay half as much for merchandise as they indicated they would be willing to pay in a survey. You all think this one is science, and this one is science. Yep, this is the easy one, but this is interesting, and, you know, what...
Oh, good. At least.
Well, you know, I mean, I didn't anticipate you guys would have problems with this one because it seems kind of obvious. But it is interesting. They just basically invalidated all previous survey-based research when it comes to things like how much people are willing to pay for stuff. And yeah, I mean, it kind of, when you think about it, if you say people like, hypothetically, how much would you be willing to pay for something? That's different than plunking down cold hard cash. Yeah, so people said they would be willing to pay twice as much as what they were actually then willing to pay in a more real setting.
I don't know. It's so funny. It surprises me because even though that makes perfect sense, it makes perfect logical sense. Like, at least in America, people aren't frugal. Mm-hmm. They just spend and they'll just put it on a credit card.
That's a generalization, Kara.
Well, we love credit.
No, it's not. Our culture is built on credit. It's crazy. It's so different than other cultures. People overspend. Everybody in America is in debt.
Kara, you're both right and you're both wrong.
Americans die with an average of $62,000 in debt.
Wow. I got a good cracking.
I know. We should save more. That shocks me how few people have any savings. No, that's crazy. How are you going to retire if you don't have any savings? Anyway.
We have a lot of debt.
Let's move to number two. A new study finds that implementation of mandatory labeling laws in Vermont was associated with a decrease in opposition to genetically modified food of 19%. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Yeah, baby.
I found this genuinely surprising. I did anticipate. So, I mean, the whole debate about mandatory labeling laws for genetically modified food, people are promoting it on the idea of transparency, that people have a right to know. That's people
wedge,
are posting
right?
it. Yeah, on the idea that it doesn't tell you anything about the product itself. They're equivalent, you know, like sugar from genetically modified sugar beets and sugar from non-genetically modified sugar beets is literally identical. So there really is nothing to know then. But they say, but if I want to ethically support systems, it's like, yeah, but it still tells you nothing because lots of crops are patented, whether they're genetically modified or not. So it basically isn't telling anything people think that think that it's telling them. And so it's inherently deceptive. And it's clear because many, many anti-GMO activists have come right out and said it. The very purpose of it is to demonize GMOs and is to ban it. This is how they are trying to ban GMOs. So if in fact labeling GMOs decreased opposition to it, that's a huge backfire, you know,
awesome.
For the labeling laws. So I'm still dubious about it, to be honest with you, because this is a very limited set of information. But what they did was they looked at, you know, the favorability and the unfavorability towards genetically modified food before the law came into effect in Vermont and also nationwide. And then after the labeling was in effect, they compared Vermont to the rest of the United States. And they found that opposition in non-Vermont, every other state but Vermont, actually increased a little bit over that period of time, which is unfortunate. And it actually decreased a little bit in Vermont. And the difference between Vermont compared to the rest of the country over that period of time was 19%. That's why I had to word it the way I did. It was a little weird. It didn't cause this 19% decrease. It was associated with a 19% decrease compared to the rest of America. So that was that variable was associated with a 19% decrease. Does that make sense? And of course, yeah, it's a correlation. You know, we can only speculate about what's going on here. But Bob, you clearly read the article because you said exactly what the researchers said. Their speculation
I did not. I actually did
not. Oh, really? Because you said exactly what they said, which was people see that their trusted brands that they've eaten their whole life are genetically modified. Like, oh, it can't be that bad then.
Yeah, they don't want to give up their blue box mac and cheese.
Jeez. So much for their principles.
Yeah, but 19%, right? If still, most story, people still oppose him. Yeah, okay. Sometimes, like, sometimes
that's bad form.
Usually, I could tell if you read the study, but this time you just hit upon exactly what they said.
Well, also, you did say, "I'm wondering if I should go last."
Is that what you said?
I did. Yeah, and that's because I mean, I pretty much
of another that item.
The fillings aren't magnetic. I mean,
yeah. So let's get back to the first one. A report indicates cases of the new 7 Tesla MRI scan show now coming into clinical use, pulling amalgam fillings out of teeth. So what is an amalgam fillings?
It's like there's a bunch of
There's a bunch of
different metals in there.
Yeah, which ones?
Compound. Oh, there's a bunch of compound material. Tin, glue.
There's tin.
Yeah, some lead, mercury.
Yeah, all the things that'll kill you.
Mercury, silver, tin, and copper. Those are the four metals in amalgam.
There's mercury in your teeth?
50%. Carrie, you're just hearing about mercury amalgam fillings. This is a whole pseudoscience unto itself. So the thing is, once you put them all together, you have to put the mercury in there to make it soft enough. Otherwise, the other ones would be too hard. But mercury also is really good at binding the silver, tin, and copper together. And then once it binds, it oxidizes on the outside, and it basically locks everything in. So there's no mercury getting out into your system. It's negligible. But there's a huge pseudoscience about, the mercury and the amalgams in your teeth are giving you autism. You know, we're causing everything bad, and you got to get them all pulled.
Babies don't have fillings.
Wait. Yeah.
Babies whatever. Just have amalgam.
Right.
And then, of course, if you get them pulled, you're exposing yourself to more mercury than if you just left them in.
Oh, I got all mine pulled. I only have composite fillings. Is that pseudoscience too?
Well, it depends on why you did it. If you did it for aesthetics.
I did it because they were leak, because they said that they shrink and grow over time and they leak. Like, they don't maintain their, and so a lot of times they have to be replaced after like 10, 15 years.
The bond breaks down.
Yeah, they're fine. So, but.
Well, they're all gone now anyway.
But mercury, silver, tin, and copper, none of those are ferromagnetic. So you couldn't magnetically pull the fillings out of your teeth. You probably could if they were ferromagnetic. 7 Tesla is freaking powerful.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
The typical MRIs that we've been using for decades is 1.5 Tesla. The 3 Teslas were the big magnets. Right now they're pulling out these 7 Tesla magnets. These are really powerful. They're capable of really detailed images. But man, you can't get anything even remotely ferromagnetic anywhere near these magnets. I bet you it could pull your fillings out. I don't know if it literally could, but if you had like iron in your teeth, that would be tough. But all right, but here's the thing. This is based on a study, which is based upon the effect of the 7 Tesla MRIs on the mercury amalgam fillings. It wasn't pulling them out of the teeth, but they did find in a study that it was associated with a little bit more leaching of the mercury out of the amalgam in the presence of the magnetic field.
Yeah.
Why would that happen?
It's because they think it's accelerating some kind of chemical reaction between saliva. They used simulated saliva and the amalgam fillings, right? So you can actually accelerate reactions by
an enzyme
adding energy to the system, right? And then magnetic fields are energy. It's like if you compress a spring and you put it in acid, it will dissolve quicker than an uncompressed spring. Did you know that?
Mm. Yep.
No, but that makes sense, I guess. Yeah.
It's still a tiny, tiny amount of mercury, but it was more than the controls where there wasn't a magnetic field. That was the study. So then I changed that to pulling the fillings out of the teeth, which would not happen. So good. So Evan, you were in the pole position, second week in a row where the first person got screwed. That was a soul loss. That is the Vanguard. It's a tough place to be on science or fiction.
It's all right. I'll be last next week.
So. But if I remember, yeah. And if you're quiet, you did ask for it this time.
Oh, I got to make a noise once in a while. I know.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
All experimentation is criticism. If an experiment does not hold out the possibility of causing one to revise one's views, it's hard to see why it should be done at all.
Absolutely.
Once said by Sir Peter B. Medawar.
And who is he?
Oh, yes. Well, we haven't spoken about him much on the show, have we? British-born biologist, born in Brazil, though, whose work on graft rejection and the discovery of acquired immune tolerance was fundamental to the practice of tissue and organ transplants. He is a co-recipient of the 1960 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for discovery of acquired immunological tolerance. Oh, once said, Stephen Jay Gould said, the cleverest man I have ever known.
Yeah, and that's a very good quote. I totally agree with that sentiment. And, you know, that's you can that's a good hallmark of a pseudoscientist that they do that when they do quote unquote experiments, they're trying to prove themselves right rather than prove themselves wrong. And they do it only to confirm what they believe. And of course, that's not doing real science. Science should have the potential.
Falsifiable. Yeah,
should have the potential to falsify what you believe. And if
that's right, what is the point?
Right. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
All right.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.